Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
And we thank you very much for tuning in live to Close Up Radio Live. This is your host, Jim Masters. Thanks for joining us today. Always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure when we have an opportunity to welcome back some of our extraordinary and revered guests, our roster of amazing guests who have stopped by Close Up Radio Live and also Close Up Television as well. And one of those incredible individuals is psychologist and author Dr. Susan Kavler Adler. She's based in New York City, and she is absolutely incredible. Now, I've had an opportunity not only to interview her on the air here on Close Up Radio Live, but also in person at her offices in Manhattan. And I can tell you, she's nothing more than very empathetic, very compassionate, and she's somebody who is curious, and she's somebody who likes to dig for answers, and she has an extraordinary, long, satisfied client list of people that she's had an opportunity to work with and help. An acclaimed clinical psychologist and psychoanalytic psychotherapist. She's the author of 7 books, 70 articles, the founder and the executive director of the Object Relations Institute for Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis. And her acclaimed books are all available on Amazon, and I think even more hot off the presses, which is very exciting. She's a prolific writer. She works with all levels of trauma, acute, chronic, or complex, because different types of trauma can affect us throughout our lives. She's widely recognized for her work in bereavement and loss, helping her clients process grief and separation and work through intense pain issues. Dr. Kavler Adler has 3 monthly online groups as well to help facilitate some of that work. She actively teaches on the faculty of the Object Relations Institute, where she serves as executive director, senior supervisor, and training analyst. She has also taught and supervised at various psychoanalytic training institutes prior to founding the Object Relations Institute in 1991, including serving on the faculty of the Postgraduate Center for Mental Health and being a training analyst, supervisor, and faculty member of the National Institute for Psychotherapies. And related to her books on women, artists, and writers, she earned an honorary doctorate in literature from Ignatius University in 2008. She's a fellow of the American Board and Academy of Psychoanalysis, and she belongs to several psychoanalytic societies, such as the Postgraduate Psychoanalytic Society and the Psychoanalysis and Psychoanalytic Psychology Society of Division 39 of the APA. Additionally, she is a psychologist with the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. Bottom line, she's busy and she loves what she does. It is my pleasure to welcome her back to our broadcast, updating us on some of the extraordinary work she's doing and a phenomenal conversation in store for you for the next 30 minutes live. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And Dr. Kavler Adler, it's wonderful to welcome you back to Close Up Radio Live as well. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, it's great to be back and to speak with you again.
It's wonderful to hear your voice again and have an opportunity to welcome you. And you've been doing well since we chatted last. All is good?
Yes, working very actively and also continuing doing Argentine tango dancing. But I do a lot with my, you know, as you've been mentioning, monthly groups, individual patients, individual supervision for people in my field and teaching classes. I also work with couples as well as individual, and I do in-depth therapy with those who are interested in a deep process. So, yeah, so I'm very active in my work. I'm dancing. I have some vacations, but and I was a keynote speaker for a conference 2 weeks ago. And so, I do a lot of different things with workshops, conferences, as well as teaching and my ongoing practice. Oh, I also got, you didn't mention, but I have had 16 awards for my books and articles. And I had a new book the last year that you didn't know about when you had interviewed me before, called Developmental
Right.
Mourning, Erotic Transference, and Object Relations Psychoanalysis. So that's especially for people in my field, but it certainly is readable for those outside. The books on women artists and writers, I always recommend to people who aren't in the field, like The Creative Mystique from Red Shoes, Frenzy to Love and Creativity, and The Compulsion to Create, because they're about well-known, fascinating women artists and writers, and about their psychobiographies and all their early traumas and how that affected and impacted their work and expressions to the world.
Congratulations on that. That's extraordinary. You have been busy since we chatted last, and I knew you'd have some wonderful updates and new things to share with us as well. On this episode, we're going to dive into a lot of different things. I think, and I mentioned, I sprinkled in the introduction, some of the incredible work you do. One of the things that sometimes plagues people and can be overwhelming is envy and jealousy, and they can be obstacles. Tell us how envy and jealousy are obstacles to creativity and relationships, and how are envy and jealousy different? A lot of people, I think envy and jealousy are one in the same, but they are vastly different.
Right. Yes. That people frequently use the word jealousy when they're really talking about envy. That's the most common colloquial error as far as the psychology of the two terms. But envy actually is the more profoundly disruptive to love and creativity, and it's particularly harmful when it's unconscious. If it's conscious, it's just an experience, like it doesn't feel good, but it can be tolerated, and I do help people I work with to tolerate their feelings of envy consciously. Sometimes it can be like biting the hand that feeds you, that you envy what someone else has. And when it's a problem is when you can't take in from another or learn from another or develop yourself because you're so envious about what the other person has that you attack what they have and you want to sometimes unconsciously destroy them and their work. When it's unconscious, it can inhibit the person who has the envy from having their own creativity when they envy that of another. And it also prevents them from learning and taking in from another because, as I said, it's like the common expression, biting the hand that feeds you. If you envy so much what the other has to offer, you can't take it in and learn from it because you want to destroy it, if not consciously, unconsciously. So envy is about wanting something somebody else has, but if you believe that you could never have it or even be on the range, within the range of developing, having what they have, then that's when it becomes destructive, when you really think you can't have for yourself and develop. It's very different from admiration, where you admire someone, but you can take in from them and know that you can also have your own things and perhaps, have accomplishments like the ones that you admire. So that's when it's more healthy, admiration. But when it's unconscious envy, that's when it can inhibit the creativity and also causes destructiveness about how one feels towards a loved person can get in the way of love as well as creativity. But jealousy is different because it involves at least three people, not just two. It's not just envying what somebody else has and maybe not, you know, wanting to devalue or put down the other person and that way destroy what they have in your mind and perhaps to others. That's envy. But when jealousy, they're overlapping, and there is envy involved with jealousy, but it's always about at least two other people where you want, like if somebody's with someone that you want to be with in a romantic way, you can be jealous, obviously, of what the other person has and having the person you want. So that's jealousy when it's like at least three people. It's not just about wanting something somebody else has, but it's about wanting a person that they have. And so there's jealousy of their relationship, not just of what the person has, but of the relationship. However, in jealousy, there is a more positive aspect that in wanting what the person the other has, you also somehow, there's some love in there in valuing what the other person is that you desire and want. So it's often not as pernicious as envy, even though we use the word jealousy often to refer to the more malignant, envious, attacking feelings or unconscious fantasies. So, but there are different, because jealousy is about envying a relationship, another with another, and envy is just about wanting what somebody else has. And then admiration is when you can appreciate what someone else has and learn from it and take it in a way to help yourself develop. So there are all those three things are different. And knowing the different psychological meanings can help people understand things that might not be conscious that become conscious through feelings, through anger or rage that someone might feel just about learning about someone else's accomplishment. They may not be aware of it, but if they learn these terms, it can help them become aware when they have a reaction like that to someone else's achievements or to someone else's relationship.
Yeah, see, that's so incredibly important. And thanks for breaking that out and really detailing the uniqueness of it and how those obstacles can blockages to creativity and relationships. What about mourning and grief? How is that? And I mentioned it a little bit in the introduction, and I know you really dig in deep with it. Tell us about your work with mourning and grief and how it's related to what you do.
Right. Well, you know, people often think about mourning just in terms of bereavement, and of course, the loss of someone you love and the bereavement for that is a very, very deep and painful process, but one can survive it if one bit by bit is able to feel the loss and be conscious of it and not deny it and not dissociate or repress the feelings about it, then one can work through the pain of bereavement. But when I talk about mourning, I'm talking about more than just the literal loss of a person you love. I'm talking about separations, which people have to grieve the loss of, divorces, separations, losses of work or even an apartment. Sometimes there's grief about any loss, and actually life is partly a human experience of loss. I mean, we can't live without loss. So I'm particularly sensitive to helping people get through anger or emptiness and feeling overwhelmed to get to a point where they can actually feel the sadness of grief and through the grief renew the love that they feel. Because sadness is at first very painful, but as you go through the mourning process, you get to a place where there's less pain in the sadness and there's more love in the sadness and a renewal of the possibility of new love and new connections. So, yes, and I was particularly sensitive to loss and mourning because at 10 years old, I lost my father and someone I love very deeply. So it made me very sensitive later on to the process of mourning and how I could help people try to sustain the feelings of the mourning process rather than to run from them or defend against them. In that way, I could give them the support that they need to get through it and to renew love and relationship and creativity as well. There was a book once, not one of mine, but a well-known trade book called Necessary Losses. There are necessary losses in all our lives. And as much as we always think of wanting positive things in our future, although we may do things to undermine that and punish ourselves for guilt or things like that, but we do think of wanting to go towards positive things, but there's always loss. I mean, every day you can think about some minor loss you feel or some memory that comes up maybe of someone not being in your life anymore. So that's all part of recognizing feelings related to mourning and grief. And the more you can be conscious of your feelings and your thoughts in general and particularly about mourning and grief, the more you can handle it and survive it and sometimes benefit from it. I have a theory called developmental mourning in one of my books, the one that came out, my seventh book that came out at the end of 2022, the developmental mourning book, is about all these stories and cases of people who grew and developed through being able to be in the mourning process with the support of psychotherapy and in some cases psychoanalysis where it was a more intensive process than psychotherapy. But I've written many, many articles about it, and the seventh book is the first of three volumes of my selected papers published by International Psychoanalytic Books, IP Books, and in there I have, I'll have two other volumes of that coming out, but they were originally journal articles that have been now chapters in this book, and they all show the story of people not only surviving mourning and getting past the pain and sometimes the rage and sense of emptiness they can feel, but actually benefiting from the mourning process itself where they grow from it. That's why I call it developmental mourning. It's a developmental process as you go through the feeling states and getting past the most painful and the most angry states to the deeper feelings of grief, sadness, and love that come up. So the process itself is developmental and growth promoting. So that's why I call it developmental mourning.
Lives you don't realize it. And that's what's wonderful about the work you do. You really have done so much.
You're being cut off. Hello? Hello? Oh, gosh. Hello, I can't hear you. Hello? I can't hear you now. The connection was cut off. Hello?
Dr. Kadler-Adler, you're there?
Yes. Now I
guess that earthquake had sort of residual results maybe with the technology and phone lines. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, it's very disconcerting. I kept saying, hello, I can't hear you.
Right. Well, for folks listening outside the New York area, there was a 4.8 earthquake today. So could be some technology snuff.
Hello? Uh-oh. Happening again?
Doctor, and their meaning?
Yes. I didn't hear the last thing you said because it was cut off, so please repeat
it. Yeah, can we go over each of your books and their meaning? Tell us about the various books.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So I have two books on well-known women artists and writers that I mentioned, The Compulsion to Create, Women Writers and Their Demon Lovers, and then The Creative Mystique from Red Shoes Frenzy to Love and Creativity. And there are powerful stories in these books that were published originally in 1996, and then were republished after Routledge with ORI Academic Press in 2013-2014. And these books go into some of the well-known people are Virginia Woolf, Anne Sexton, Camille Claudel, Diane Arbus, Catherine Mansfield, and as well as Emily Dickinson in the first book, The Compulsion to Create, Charlotte Bronte in her brilliant last psychological book, Villette, that came after Jane Eyre, and about Emily Dickinson's poetry and Emily Bronte's work, and Edith Sitwell, the British performance artist poet. But there are others. There's Suzanne Farrell in the New York City Ballet, and her whole story with Balanchine is in the Creative Mystique book from Red Shoes Frenzy to Loving Creativity. Those are the two on women artists and writers, and you learn a lot about the creative process in these books, as well as how trauma and developmental losses can affect and shape the work and the kind of characters that people have in their work if they're writers. The work in general can be shaped, whether it's visual arts or written work. In literature, it can be shaped by, it is shaped by our earliest experiences and losses and traumas, as well as, of course, by positive things from our early life. So those are those two books. Then I have a book called Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change, which has in-depth clinical cases where you actually see the dialogues and thoughts of the patient as they're going through the mourning process. And the mourning process is seen to open up spirituality and creativity, and as well as erotic passion and the capacity for feeling fully as an erotic human being with love relationships. So the developmental mourning process can be seen with the dialogues and the thoughts of the patients right there as they go through it with me and have the support of the treatment with me, how all these capacities open up in them. And the dreams and fantasy life are there because I work with the inner world and dreams and fantasies all the time, so that the inner world becomes enriched also, and you get more positive relationships within by going through the mourning process. People can get attached to their early negative objects, but we call them objects in object relationships, they're people. They get what we call them objects when they get internalized inside, but there are both positive and negative internalizations of others. And in mourning, you get to open that world up, and the dreams, fantasies open up, and there's an enriching of the inner world and a capacity for taking in better relationships and connections in the present can become possible. So creativity, love, eroticism, and spirituality open up. So that book is called Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change, and it's published by Routledge in 2000 and 3, and it actually got the National Gradiva Award from the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. And then I have a book called Anatomy of Regret, because the experience of regret is part of the human psyche and the human existential experience too. And regret can be part of the mourning process. If we become conscious of our regrets and don't deny them, which goes against the famous song, I Have No Regrets by Pilaf, I think her name is. But in any case, everyone actually has regrets. If they think they have no regrets, they're just unconscious of their regrets. So in therapy, I can help people to allow those unconscious regrets to become conscious, because if you're conscious of your regrets, you can learn from them so that you don't keep repeating the same self-sabotaging mistakes that created the regret. And so it's very important to be conscious of your regrets and own them and acknowledge them, because you learn that way, and then not to repeat the same self-sabotaging behavior that led to the regrets in many cases. And if they're kept unconscious, you can't do that, and you can keep repeating the same mistakes and, you know, reliving the same self-sabotage, because you're not owning that you have certain regrets and remembering what went on. Instead, you're unconsciously being affected by it, and then you just stay stuck in that vicious cycle of repeating the same mistakes. So that's one of my books too, Anatomy of Regret. And then I do have, and then there's the Klein-Winnicott Dialectic. That would be more for people in my field, because, and I'm sure there are therapists who listen to this, if Melanie Klein and D.W. Winnicott are famous British theorists, and that book is about how their mothers influenced their theories and how their early lives influenced their theories. And it also shows how I have integrated some of the most potent clinical parts of their theories to do clinical work, and how I've integrated that into developmental mourning. And Klein and Winnicott together, rather than being opposed to each other, as unfortunately happened in Britain, they really work together in a complementary way in clinical work. So that book is called The Klein-Winnicott Dialectic, Transformative New Metapsychology and Interactive Clinical Theory. That's more for people in my field. And then the other books, I mentioned the developmental mourning book with the cases of people growing through mourning. And then there's one other book in the 7 so far published, and that's my tango book called Saturday Nights at Lafayette Grill, a totally different kind of book, written more by me as an Argentine tango dancer, not as a psychologist so much. But I did interviews with top professionals in tango who do talk about the psychological way that they understand Argentine tango and its benefits for health, and how they teach it. And I also have personal essays in there from the tango world. It's called Saturday Nights at Lafayette Grill, Two Tales and Gossips of the New York City Argentine Tango Scene. And that was published with Mindmen Press. Okay, thank you for asking that question about all my books.
That's absolutely extraordinary. Why was it significant for you to express yourself through writing as well as dancing, with your former work as a dance therapist and as an advanced Argentine tango dancer? And how do these capabilities as a writer and a dancer actually help you tune in to people in clinical work?
Yes, thank you for that question. I think that because I'm so verbal as a writer, I'm very attuned to the meaning of people's speech. And when they're not saying things as well as when they are saying things, I'm very tuned into that. And of course, the symbolic meaning of the words and what they're telling me, whether it's just a thought or a feeling or a fantasy or a dream, and dreams have different parts of the person within them and the different characters of the dream, different parts of them. So I'm very, very in touch with the words that people use as a writer, particularly verbal. But I also, as a dancer, and yes, formerly I did a little dance therapy. I was trained as a dance therapist. At the same time, I was getting my doctorate in clinical psychology in the first years of my 20s. I got my PhD in 1974. And at the same time I was getting my PhD in clinical psychology, I had started young. I also was doing dance therapy and studied it experientially with Blanche Evan, who was a pioneer in the field. So I'm also very tuned in to the nonverbal communications of people and people I work with in clinical work. I'm very aware of what they might show with their gestures, facial expression, movements, and I can help them be aware, because people, obviously, the therapy, psychoanalytic psychotherapy process is always one of helping people to be conscious of what's unconscious. So sometimes, you know, people will have stomach aches and headaches and they're not conscious of the anger and rage they're feeling. And that's one thing that they put into their bodies and act out in their bodies nonverbally. Or they can get even more destructive unconsciously and create ulcers and real organ damage. But there's also just the nonverbal behavior. It could be pre-verbal things that people experienced early in their life, and only their unconscious remembers it. They don't remember it consciously, because we have a normal forgetting that goes on till about 5 years old in general. Unless there was earlier trauma, then people may remember things at 2 years old if they had traumatic disruption of bonding with the mother and didn't get what they needed that time at a critical time of where the self is forming. But there is generally a forgetting. So I can help people become conscious of what's unconscious, and sometimes it comes through facial expressions or movements or, you know, like if they make a hand wave like they're brushing something aside, you can help them see they don't want to look at something. Or once I was working with someone who was lying on my couch, and he was motioning with his foot like he had a foot on the brake, like he was in the car putting his foot on the brake. And I was able to make him aware that he was getting anxious about the intensity of his feelings and the thoughts and what that were coming up, and so he was putting a brake on it. So when I interpreted that to him, I told him he was showing me that he was putting a brake on what he was saying and stopping his process just then, and I could see it through his foot, literally, like he was putting his foot on the brake. As soon as he realized that, he was able to see what it was that he was blocking that way, what he was afraid of feeling, and then we could go on with the process, help him understand the meaning of what he was feeling and talking about just then.
That is amazing. How can a fear of success hold people back? What creates this?
That comes from... There are two main levels of that. There can be abandonment fears from early on. If they felt like at 2 years old when somebody is separating from the mother, if the mother can't tolerate the kid becoming more autonomous, learning to walk away and can walk away from her, the mother wants to hold the child back. Because the mother hasn't fully developed, hasn't had the good enough mothering she needs, and she holds the child back, then there can be a fear of abandonment if the child goes towards autonomy and walking away from her sometimes and towards others and not just staying with mommy. But if they feel mommy is going to retaliate by withdrawing emotionally or dropping them in some way from connection, then there can be an unconscious terror of abandonment if they go forward in their life towards autonomy, towards success. And then there's another level at around 5 years old, what we call the Oedipal period, where there's a natural competitiveness that a child feels towards, usually towards the opposite sex parent. Sometimes it's towards the same sex parent, but it's generally towards the opposite parent, a competitive feeling. And if they fear retaliation for their competition with the parent, then that too can become an unconscious block to moving forward and having any success or separating from that parent in any way. And then they sabotage themselves or don't go forward in intended wishes for the agendas of their lives that they might want. So I work with someone in a psychoanalysis for a number of years who is a writer, and she wasn't able to write when she first came to me. She had tremendous writing blocks. And through our work, bringing things to consciousness, and through her mourning her mother who had died, she had a lot of attacking internally from the voice of her mother, because she imagined her mother to resent any movement she made towards success and through being an artist, you know, writing. Because the mother was an artist, but she died during her midlife when she got cancer. And so my patient or client imagined that she was threatening her mother if she were to write and be successful. So she would block her writing. And she would have this attacking voice in her head if she did a move towards writing. But all this was modified through her mourning process and through understanding her anger and rage towards her mother, as well as her grief and loss, and her empathy for the mother eventually really came out. In the end, actually, she told me she had more gratitude now towards her mother for what she received, as opposed to feeling so much guilt. And in the beginning, it was more persecutory anxiety, not just guilt. It was like a self-attack with imagining the voice of her mother in her head and imagining that she also would die and her mother would meet her and scold her for moving ahead. So once she became conscious of these things and modified that voice and owned her own voice, she found her own self-expressive voice. And then she started writing and publishing and getting awards and everything. But she had so much anger at me because she thought of me as always being actively writing, because she knew I published a lot. So she was always furious at times that she thought she was stuck and I was moving ahead. Mm-hmm. See, here we talk about envy. She was so furious. But because I could accept her feelings of rage and understand them, it helped her move through those periods, because the anger at the mother was being transferred to me. And by my receiving the anger and still being there for her and not retaliating, she had a much, she didn't have to be frightened anymore of this internal mother, because she transferred it onto me and I was able to take it and to be there and still support her and be glad when she moved ahead into writing and successes.
We're almost out of time. Actually, we're a little past time. We're going a little past only because of the little earthquake hiccup there. What is the demon lover complex?
Okay, well, this is another theme I've written about a lot, particularly in those two books on women artists and writers, because they could have demon lover kind of male figures in their work. These were all women I was writing about then. I have written about many male cases, but these books were on women artists and writers. So they had it had to do with early maternal deprivation or trauma, which is compounded then by disappointments with the father and other men, and then the internal male figure turns into what we call a bad object as opposed to a positive internal person within them. And you see this, I mean, it doesn't have to be in an art, like with a writer. You see it there explicitly in writing, but with people who aren't necessarily artists, they just express it often in their relationships where they get involved with people who are negative for them, sometimes abusive, and they get attached and can't let go because it repeats this early combination of mother-father negativity. And so then they develop a whole complex about being attached to a, what we call a bad object or a demon lover when it becomes eroticized, and it's like an attachment to an erotic bad other inside of them. And then they might select people in their lives that they get attached to aren't good for them. But, you know, in contrast to that, you have someone like Suzanne Fallon, New York City Ballet, who had good enough mothering, and even though there was father disillusionment, she was able to keep a positive view of George Balanchine, even when he blacklisted her all over America and wouldn't let her dance anywhere after she was his prima ballerina because she refused to marry him and married someone else. She had to go to Europe to, and this is one of the stories that's in the Creative Mystique, she had to go to Europe to be on stage again. And then she came back eventually and worked with Balanchine again. She was able to forgive him and to keep a positive view of him. This is in contrast to a demon lover complex, that she was able to keep a positive view of someone who actually was acting maliciously towards her at one point, blacklisting her all over America. But because she had enough good internal mother inside and other inside, she was able to keep a positive view of him and came back and worked with him and taught his work and continued to, when she couldn't dance anymore, she continued to teach his work. So she really was a contrast to the demon lover complex. She didn't have, she had a real life demon lover who she kept positive in her mind and didn't turn into a complex of a demon lover. She didn't get attached to the bad part of the relationship. She stayed attached to a positive view and was able to move on and marry and then to eventually teach and dance. You know, well, she danced again, and then she was able to teach as a dance teacher later and with Balanchine.
That's so incredible. So real quick, we've got about just a minute left. The future plans for you and books, and hopefully we'll chat some more and hear some more success stories and other wonderful things. It's always a delight to have you with us here on the show. But real quick, what are some things that you're looking forward to for the future?
Okay, well, I'll just mention some books. I have 5 other books that I have completed besides the 7 that were published, and they will be coming out. They're being edited. 2 of them will be 2 more volumes of my selected papers with IP books, and one of them is actually called The Demon Lover Complex. It's in the title, and the 3rd one is other theories. Then I have other books, a creative nonfiction book that's a whole other kind of writing I've done about the story of an ex-strip of that I helped to get through college, and she was not a patient. She was just someone who worked for me as a little bit as an assistant and who I got friendly with.
Yeah.
But a very fast story about her life. And then there's a textbook on object relations thinking with 65 object relations terms and clinical examples for that Routledge, I believe, will be publishing. And then there's a book on women, well-known women like Judy Garland, Marilyn Monroe, and Maria Callas, and about it's about their sense of betrayal. It's called the Betrayal of the Seduced Woman. Okay, that's it. All right.
It's amazing. Yeah, really amazing. our special guest, psychologist and author, Dr. Susan Kevler Adler, here on the show. This episode is recorded in its entirety, so you can hear it again. And the website, what is the website or place that people can go to learn more, Doctor?
Yes. Please go to www.kavaleradler.com, K-A-V-A-V as in victory, A-L-E-R-A-D-L-E-R.com, K-A-V-A-L-E-R-A-D-L-E-R.com. So I have a lot on my website. I also have over 30 free YouTube videos that people can watch. And if you go to my website, you can get there too, to those YouTube videos. But my books are all there, and my groups are just there.
Yeah,
and
wonderful.
I also have interviews there, including the in-person interview I did here with in my office here with Jim Masters. And
that's right.
That's all on my website. Yes.
Uh-huh. That is fantastic.
And people can do my email that way and contact me. Yeah.
Look forward to chatting with you and expanding more down the line, Doctor. Always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Close Up Radio here live. Always really a delight. And come see us again, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your day and you enjoy the time with me as much as I have with you.
Oh, I've enjoyed it very much. I really love getting a chance to express these things to people. Thank you very much, Jim, and I very much enjoyed meeting with you again.
Absolutely. You are very, very welcome. Dr. Susan Kevler Adler, our very special guest here on the Jim Masters Show, live at Jim Masters Show. I'm Jim Masters, Close Up Radio Live. And we had a wonderful conversation with her, and look forward to chatting with her again real soon. Thanks for listening to Close Up Radio Live. A real pleasure to have you with us all around the world. We just did a little extra time here because there was a little technical issue during the show. So we went a little extra for our very valued guest. And we thank you for listening as well. For all of us at Close Up Radio and Close Up Television, this is Jim Masters thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, and come see us again right here on Close Up Radio Live. Till then, for all of us, have a great day. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.